This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Jikoji Zen Center. It's really lovely to have you. How many of you, it's your first time here? Okay, almost half the room. That's pretty great. How many of you, it's your first time doing Zen meditation or any kind of meditation? That's pretty great. Wow. Yeah. It's really, really special. And really special that you chose this time to come try meditation. Yeah? Because this is a very special time of year for Buddhists. You know, these strange seekers that you're surrounded by. This time of year is around the time of year we celebrate Buddha's awakening. Which is really interesting because we have a retreat going on right now. Sesshin. We call it a sesshin. It's a meditation intensive, really. Retreat makes it sound very pleasant. And sesshin can sometimes be very difficult. Yeah. So this sesshin, this retreat that we're doing right now, it's in its last full day. It's called Rohatsu. This retreat, Rohatsu, is basically the December 8th retreat. So, it's kind of interesting in that half the Buddhist world decided that December 8th is going to be the day we're going to mark Buddha's enlightenment. And the other half of the Buddhist world still follows this lunar calendar. Right? So, kind of like Judaism or other faiths, where the holidays move around every year. You know? So what's really special about this year is this is one of the years where Bodhi Day, Awakening Day, or the day that we use to mark Buddha's enlightenment, is December 8th and the full moon are pretty much at the same time, or pretty much on the same day. So, well, every day is a very special day. I like to mark this kind of moment because how powerful that is, at least for me in my practice, this feeling of all of us sitting down together and meditating together. We're doing this with millions of other Buddhists right now. And because the moon and December 8th are really near each other, then millions and millions and millions of Buddhists are together meditating, chanting, practicing to commemorate Buddha's enlightenment. So some of us have been here in Jikoji, mostly in this room, for the past 7 days, meditating. And for a lot of people, this was their first retreat. So I have a handful of people that join us. This is their first session. Really, really great. So, all of you newcomers, I want to really welcome you. And I love that we're all interspersed and all mixed up together here. meditating for a long time. In a long time this week. And people, that is the first time. All mixed up together. So you're joining a bunch of people. And I say, you know, how do you know which ones have been meditating this whole time? How do you know? Well, I know because I started with them that their mannerisms have softened, maybe slowed, calmed down. I also know a lot of their faces have softened, which is a really beautiful, unique thing about sitting in this seat, watching people meditate for a week. So there have been people all around you that have been meditating for a week. There might be some Buddhas among you. Huh? And to all of you who have been here all week, thank you for graciously welcoming the newcomers. And I say, look out, there may be some Buddhas among you. Okay? So around this time, we like to tell some of the same stories. The stories about Buddha's life and Buddha's awakening. So I will tell you a little bit of that story now. I ask that you make sure that you're seated comfortably and sustainably, right? We were talking about that with the first timers. We're talking about what it is to have a sustainable practice, you know? Make sure you're comfortable. We make sure we're comfortable and we're seated, and we trust that the room will hold us, and practice will hold us. That our breath will come and go. Now I'm speaking to you as someone pointing the way toward what has already been experienced this week and already been experienced in your hearts, even if it's your first time. But it's a story about a certain person. But it's all of our story, right? It's all of us. It's the story of a person who would just simply stay and not turn away. Before he became the Buddha, he was known as Siddhartha. He was a human, I think, who maybe had tried everything. He tried this and he tried that. He had known renunciation, and he had known strain and effort. He studied with wise ones. He tested the limits of his body. And at the end of those years of long effort, of ascetic practice, he still had one burning question. Is liberation truly possible? Can humans really do this? Can humans wake up? So he kept searching and he kept practicing. And this kind of searching and practicing were not a matter of pride. If anything, they were a matter of honesty and a deep calling. But like many of you, the usual strategies we have, the tricks stop working. Or where our wealth, or our knowledge, or our cleverness kind of fail to quiet the ache. I believe Siddhartha arrived at such a place. And so, he found a tree by a river, and he sat down. So it's really easy, I think, to make this exalted hero out of the Buddha, or even make him into a god or some supernatural thing. And we believe that he was very ordinary. Ordinary in all the ways that matter. He was just fully human, in that he had fears. He had doubts, he had attachments. So the power of this story is not how different he was from us. So after many years of basically living in the forest, practicing meditation, studying with different wise ones and ascetics, and refining his question and his understanding again and again, he finally took his place underneath the Bodhi tree. And he resolved to sit down, just like we did. We resolved to sit down. Some of us here for 1 week together. And night fell. And in the old versions of the story, we say Mara came forth. The embodiment of temptation, of evil, of distraction. But I sometimes find it more beneficial to not think of Mara as a demon, to not put a funny hat on him and make him a little monster that lives under my bed, but instead know it's that quality of my mind or my avoidance or it's my schedule. I can't. It's just my schedule. But Mara is just then the mind's clever apparatus to assemble illusions and keep us safe in that illusion. Keep us feeling safe in that illusion. So we like to say that Mara is this embodiment of fear or desire or pride or shame or even distraction. Mara is the voice that maybe has you arrange your life so that you don't have to look. So funny, because I thought that Mara would be this big demon that I'd have to battle, but I find Mara in my own courtesy sometimes, and poor boundaries. Mara knows how to dress himself up, it seems, right? I'm getting some knowing, nodding looks. Feel like Mara will dress himself up, or herself up, or himself up in whatever garb will be believed. And so Mara came forth with all sorts of illusions, delusions, and temptations for Buddha to try and tug him off his path. He sat and even resolved himself to sit and to continue sitting until he put this question to rest. And of course Mara had to appear. In some versions of the stories, there are armies that come that Mara brings forth, or dancing ladies, or, you know, maidens strewn flower petals. You know, all kinds of different versions of the story. Pick your favorite. Pick your favorite. But in my favorite versions of the story, Mara says some really dastardly things, some really evil things. And one of them was to poke at Buddha and just say, "Who do you think you are?" Or, "Who are you to claim that which you claim? Who are you to take this ground? You're too small. You're too sinful. You're too distracted. You're too prone to failure." And with each rhetorical blow, Buddha sat. That's all he did. He just sat. It's a very simple, very profound thing. To find a deep courage to just stay sometimes when we need to stay. Not this loud theatrical thing, this storybook versions where there's armies and maidens coming at me. For me, it's Google Calendar and an exploding inbox, you know? Oh my God. Yeah. Why wouldn't it be? And sometimes when I feel that feeling, oh my God, what am I doing? I feel that feeling, and I come back to this small little courage that I have that says, I'm not going to let my mind's noise carry me away. And I think that's what the core of this story is really about. Or at least that's what I'm talking about this year. So when Mara showed up and demanded proof from Buddha, proof of Buddha's enlightenment, and said some really dastardly things like, "Who are you to be enlightened? Who do you think you are?" More than any army, that's what knocks me off my cushion. That's what makes me feel unstable. And many of you know this story. I've heard many versions of this story over the years, but of course Mara demands proof. Show it to me. Show me the proof. And what does Buddha do? But he reaches down with one hand and he touches the earth. That's it. That's his proof. And that gesture deserves our attention because it's so ordinary. He didn't brandish a title. "I am the most exalted, highly awakened, fully realized." No. He reached down and he touched the earth. He didn't arrange a spectacle. Placing his hand on the ground, the text then says, "The earth bore witness." What does that mean? That the earth bears witness to Buddha's enlightenment? Well, in one sense, it means that reality answers. I like to think of it as reality answered reality. Or in another sense, when we stop posturing and we have nothing to prove, and we have nothing to prove, we have nothing to prove. The world can meet us just as it is, just as we are. So touching the earth isn't this metaphysical magic trick that Buddha was doing. It was an act of acknowledgement. At least I would like to think in my own deluded way. This is how I interpret the story. It was an act of acknowledgement, saying this body belongs to the world. This mind belongs to the world. And when I stop insisting, it is something other than that. Something other than I am. It's so amazing that then what happens next is Mara just vanishes or leaves or tucks his tail and runs, depending on the version of the story. So again, no fireworks, no great battle. Just dissolves. And those of you who are new here, your first time, or those of you who have been sitting sesshin all week, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're sitting and you see the thought, and you see how empty it is, and it dissolves, just like Mara. Nothing to prove, nothing to gain. So at dawn, Buddha sits through the night. At dawn, a star arose. And Buddha, seeing the star, not with a new understanding, with something he's gained, but with a clarity he already had that he used to cut through all his stories and all the delusions he'd been telling himself. And seeing that star, he recognized the nature of things. And I think that's amazing, because it's not out of cleverness, but instead out of wakefulness, out of paying attention, which is something we can all do, no matter our ability. It's just clear seeing and not fooling ourselves. So as soon as Buddha saw that star with that clarity in his heart, the sense of separateness between himself and others and everything dissolved. And again, what's amazing about this story is this wasn't a theory. This wasn't something he wrote out, a formula for us. It was something he experienced for himself, a direct experience for himself. And then he did not say, wow, I achieved something. Instead, the tradition tells us that immediately after awakening, his tone was a tone of recognition of shared nature. He said, touching the ground, I and the great earth and all beings awaken together. Right? This earth, this expression of this earth, like I was talking about in my Dharma talk last week, this rising up of the earth. It was not a boastful thing. It was not a clever thing, but instead an intimate thing that came from within Buddha. And that awakening revealed not only the nature of our suffering, but how it ceases. And also how none of us are actually separate from that field of arising and ceasing. So once, a long time ago, I was very ill. I have two or three different health conditions, along with being deaf, which I don't consider a health condition. I just consider it an awesome way to be. But I also have some other challenging health conditions that are like a moving target. You know, this autoimmune stuff really kicks my butt sometimes. And one time I was really, really ill and I was in the hospital. And I'm from the Northeast. And so I was in a hospital in New York City. And they asked me if I would like a Buddhist chaplain. I thought, oh, right on. I usually only get that in California. So there I was. I guess a social worker came by and saw me with my prayer beads. And I think I might have had a samurai jacket on. She said, are you a Zen Buddhist priest? I was like, yes. How do you know that? Who are you? I'm the social worker here, and I'm in charge of, you know, the faith-based care and blah, 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 blah. Oh. And she said, and we have a Zen Buddhist priest on chaplain on staff. Would you like to meet with him? Sure. It's really interesting, yeah. So a monk comes in. It's a Rinzai monk. We'll allow it. We're Soto. There's two brands. There's Pepsi and Coke. Pepsi came in the door. So this Rinzai monk comes in. And what did he do? He sees that I'm a monk. Takes a look at my chart, a couple of hellos, and just sat down. And I remember being so scared and really alone. And it's a very terrible feeling to be in a crowded hospital in a crowded city and be so alone. I remember feeling, oh, terrible, terrible. And I offered that up to the chaplain. I don't know what to do. I feel really scared. I don't want to die. And if I do die, I don't want it to look like this. This is crap. And the chaplain said, without missing a beat, do not expect a mystical exit from an ordinary life. Thanks, doctor. Just work on your bedside manner. But he knew. He knew that he could sit next to another Zen priest and hold his hand and sit next to him. And said, you know this. Do not expect a mystical exit from an ordinary life. What did you think? Awakening was going to remove the weather? Or that your knee wouldn't hurt in Zion? And Sensei said, pull at the right thread and finally figure your life out. Ah, then it will be okay. Sickness still visits us. Loss still will visit us. What changes, the only thing that changes, is the manner in which we meet these things. That's it. The texts and the teachers of all ages point to that, and to these small signs of gentler speech, of ease with our anger, and of a hands-on tenderness in ordinary tasks that we call mindfulness. And that's how awakening shows up. It shows up not as fireworks, but it shows up in like how you care for yourself, how you wash your face in the morning, how you wash your bowl during sesshin, how you greet your neighbor, your homeless neighbor, your unhoused, addicted neighbor. In other words, beginner's mind can't just be a slogan. It has to be a real spirituality. It has to be an orientation and a humility and an openness. And I think it means even with a lifetime of practice, we have to return again and again to the basics, to body, to breath, to being alive, to being sore and achy. Because the extraordinary occurs in the ordinary when we stop hiding from it. And sometimes when we stop looking for it and looking for it to be so magical all the time. So I'll tell you one other little story. I think I told this story before, but again, when I lived in New York City, I was a monk in New York City, if you can believe that. We had this same rohatsu practice. But sometimes when we would meet in the city, we would sometimes do 1 week, but sometimes we would just do 1 day. And we would meditate all through the night, too. So on December 7th, we would meditate all night into December 8th, into Bodhi Day. So all these people would come from all over the city and pile in this Zenno together, sit until the sun came up. It's really wonderful. And then we'd all go to Balthazar and have an overpriced breakfast or something, because it was New York City. But 1 year, I was coming to the Zendo, and I was thinking about Buddha and his story, and I was thinking about this morning star. And I was leaning over a railing, looking at the Hudson River in New York, by New York City. And I had an app on my phone, this is about 10, 15 years ago, that enabled you to hold it up to the sky, and you could have like a star chart, and you could find out where the stars were. Oh, there's Orion! And you could click on Orion, and it could tell you all the names of the stars in the constellations, and it would tell you where they're going to be, where they're going to move across the sky. A beautiful little app. I really loved it. Poking around. And you could even point it straight down. What stars is Australia seeing right now? Well, I'm looking through the earth. I really like this little fun little app. So I found myself, I don't know where I was, at Battery Park or something, and I'm leaning over and I'm looking at the Hudson River, and I have this moment and I thought, oh, it's December 7th and I'm headed to the Zendo. I wonder where the morning star is. I wonder where Venus is right now, right? The morning star is Venus. I said, oh, cool. I've got an app for that. So I take out my phone and I start messing. or that email, and I'll skip over that text message. I got to download the update. Okay, I'm ready. All right, now I'm going to look around. And where's Venus? And I'm looking at all these constellations, and it should be right. It should be right here. It should be somewhere between the Empire State Building and, you know, Venus should be right here. And I'm looking and looking, and I can't find it. And eventually, I'm poking around in the menu. And it says, you've got the free version. To download the planets, $3.99. Shit. And I have this wonderful moment of standing in the middle of my life. In the middle of everybody's life, let's be honest, this is New York City. Trying to catch my breath at the river, you know? Looking out at the dusky city and the twinkling lights, and the lights reflecting off the water, the lights reflecting from behind me, and glass, every building is glass, 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 and the water. And I'm looking out and I'm thinking, where are the stars? Where's Venus? Where am I? You know, and I saw myself, and I put the phone away, and I said, I'm here. I'm in the middle of my life. I'm in the middle of New York City. I'm on the way to the Zendal. I allowed myself to be foolish. I allowed myself to be honest. And I think sometimes that's how the night works. We can sit and allow ourselves to be foolish or honest or mythic. Or allowed our stories to just unravel and dissolve. And so Siddhartha's tale is like that. It's our tale. And when we look at it, we don't see any parallel lines in the warp and the weft. We just see all this braiding of our life and of Siddhartha's and of Joshin's, Nitha's, David's, Etsudo's. We see it all together, of Masha's, of Rohatsu's. Hey Mac, how you doing? It's in the small, countless awakenings. Not because small awakenings are less quiet or more profound, but because it's the whole thing. And finally, I just want to say something about compassion. One feature of the awakening story that we often turn to that I think is overlooked is this transformation of what might have been a moment of triumph into just a moment of compassion. Because what happened next after Buddha saw into the nature of all things is he vowed to stay and to teach. I think that the awakened heart never ascends onto a pedestal, you know? An awakened heart instead recognizes kinship with all beings. So when Siddhartha recognized that fundamental interconnectivity, or as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, the interbeing, he didn't say, now I can, from up on high, I can now maybe fix some of these things. He immediately, you know, turned towards others. The path that unfolded for him from that dark, mythic, mystical, ordinary night was not to withdraw, but instead to engage. His clarity brought responsibility. responsibility as coerced action, but responsibility as a responsive heart. So in our personal practice, this means seeing our own confusion as it is, seeing it plainly. And when we see our own confusion and we're intimate with it, we're less likely to judge others for their confusion. Because as a person who has looked at Mara and understands how persuasive Mara can be, I also know that it can open my heart. So when you're tempted to make your practice into some kind of specialness, or to think of yourself as advanced or permanently stalled, instead, turn compassion and meet myself. Meet that confusion just as it is. And learn to hold things without judgment. So here's a humble question. One that you might maybe carry with you like a pebble in your pocket. When the world asks you next to prove yourself, or you feel unsure and that need to prove yourself, where will you place your hand? Will it come down and meet the earth? Will you put your hand down into your own life, on the work that you do, on the person that you are right now? So I love this story. I love practicing this story every year. I love trying to embody this story. I love trying to reach deep down into my life, into myself. And remember that awakening is not some kind of reward for our effort. It's usually just the recognition that comes when we stop buying into our delusions. So we have this opportunity, this practice, to come back again and again, and come back into our breath and our body, and allow our breath to break that spell of separation. Allow our breath to help us reach down into our lives and to root ourselves, reach into the earth. Because compassion and clarity are never separate. Clear seeing softens the heart. So I want to close with this little dedication. Place your hands in gacho with me. May this story, this Bodhi story, the story that came out of a dark night, grow into something alive in you, in your daily life. May you meet your own Mara in whatever costume it appears, with the courage to stay and to reach deep down into the earth. And may the earth answer you as surely as you are answering it, as surely as the one who sat under the tree. I think we have a little time for some questions and some answers. question, you can just raise your hand and I can help. Maybe you have a question about my weird ambling talks that they don't typically make much logical sense, but maybe make some emotional sense. I hope. Maybe you have a question about your practice. And if you do, please raise your hand. I have a sign language interpreter on the screen, so you can just speak clearly and loudly, and they'll be able to hear you and they can interpret for me. And I'll know what you're saying. So, any questions or comments? Any questions from the peanut gallery?
Oh, I had one. I was curious if you could talk with Mara about creating a structure that enables us to make good choices. Just like, say, with if you're trying to eat healthy, there's certain things you can do to eat healthy, like not bringing home a bag of potato chips or something.
Sure. And are potato chips unhealthy again? Or are they healthy now? I don't know. I don't know.
Depends on which one you
We
pick.
have this, I think, yeah, I think this is a really, and did you all hear that question? Did you hear that? Okay. I think this is a really important question. And we were talking about this a little bit during our pretty much silent session here. Silent for a week. This feeling sometimes that we have where we're coming to this cushion again and again throughout the day, all day, day after day. It's impossible to sit really strong every period. You know? It's, I don't know if that's possible. A lot of us tried. We tried our damnedest. But there's this feeling of wobbling and of falling down, of falling apart emotionally. We talked about how Corbin would say maybe every 15 minutes or 40 minutes you have to build yourself back up again. And it's like, I picture like a bunch of stones, you know, it's like a pile that's spread out that needs to be regathered. So by having those structures that hold us together and help us stay committed. So one of those we talk about is the Buddha, you know, and the Dharma, this awakening in us and the teachings. But it's also the Sangha, the third jewel. And I love that because I know that sometimes when I feel a little wobbly in my practice, sometimes literally wobbly, you know, I can feel the strength of somebody seated next to me, sitting strong. And I can almost use their practice to help me stay strong. So I feel like I'm leaning on them a little bit, leaning on this pillar of practice next to me, right? So we find these pillars of practice in our life and we orient ourselves to them. So for me, it's a lot of sangha. I'm also a psychotherapist, so I'm really interested and I got a lot of intrapersonal charge. I like people. You know, a lot of you find it in the work that we do, in the care. So finding these pillars and organizing your life around them is really important, these structures. Yeah. And Mara will come in and say, I don't really think you need that. I don't really think you need to sit every day. You sat yesterday. And so you can say, oh, it's okay. And just like every other thought, I just kind of go, huh, that's a thought. Not a good one or a bad one. It's my thoughts. There they are. I'm still going to go sit. And Mara can bah, 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 and do this and that. And I can be just like Buddha. And I'm going to be just a little more solid and just kind of stay. So, you know, signing up for commitments it gives me structure, you know. Volunteering, showing up, helping somebody else. So yeah, make your practice now, finding what those pillars of practice are and orienting yourself to them. Make them your life, okay? And with my little sangha, we're kind of coming up with a methodology. We talk about our zazen, it's a core practice. We have our study we try and do every day. We do a little bit of body work, right? Take care of our health, our eating, all of the health stuff. We talk about creativity. Creativity is a huge piece of this. Mm. What I learn and can make my own and understand it, right? And then also our engaged practice. We have to give back. We have to apply it somewhere. Yeah? Thank you for the question. Yes, Stephen.
So surviving the hospital bed in New York, do you attribute that to luck, to medical things, or to meditation?
I died. I'm a ghost.
Why did you come back?
Damn it. You see, a good Zen student won't let you go. I tried to slip out of that question. What brought me back was a lot of mice.
New York City.
I had a lot of powerful medications, including a chimera medication that was a chimera of mouse DNA and human DNA put together, and a new form of biologic medication that really, really helped me and helped stop a cascading immune issue that I was having, and helped me get a correct diagnosis. So, in a really strange way, I thank modern medicine, I thank the good, hard-working doctors and nurses, physicians assistants and care staff at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, you know, all of that. But I also thank the little mice that were in me now, I guess. That's why I want cheese. But it's, you know, feeling that it wasn't one thing. Feeling that it was a response of my whole life and in many things. Seen and unseen, these forces that came together. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh will talk about this cup of tea. It's the tea. It's the water. It's the earth. So I'm drinking the sky, the farmer, the tea farmer, and his son, and the daughter going to school. It's like, it's somehow all here, right? So I don't know if there's one thing that really brought me back. I'm sure my doctor and my surgeon are like, I think I did that. It wasn't one thing that brought me back, but it was a whole concept of a lot of things that I am still learning about, and still learning to express gratitude for. Okay, I think I've said way too much. I think we'll stop there.
Bottom of page 2.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.